It was one of those hot, humid, buggy Wisconsin summers where it went from snow to sauna in a week and a half and stayed there. The boys spent it perpetually wet from the lake, the sprinkler, a surprisingly durable water slide Rue built out of trash bags on his grandmother's front lawn. Carmelo taught Rigel to knit. At first, she thought it was the resemblance of the needles to something a ninja might own that appealed to him. And maybe it was. But he fixed on it like Santa sunscreen and spent the summer trailing training scarves everywhere, dropped stitches unraveling like plot threads. Ben used practice tassels as bookmarks. Jupiter used abandoned projects as bedding. Orion employed them as bandanas, sweatbands, do-rags, tube tops, cummerbunds, and toga tails, coming down to lazy summer breakfasts as Bruce Springsteen and Julius Caesar, equally ancient in his mind, 50 Cent and Fred Astaire. But Claude wore them as long, flowing hair tresses that cascaded down his back or could be attached via headband, then rubber banded up like a real ponytail. Rue began a practice he'd hone to an art in the years to come, pretending he wasn't related to any of them. This is G.P. Gottlieb, host of New Books in Literature for the New Books Network. And today I'm talking to Lori Frankel about her book, This Is How It Always Is. In this big, warm-hearted, juicy novel, Frankel tells the story of a couple who want their son to be whoever he wants to be, even if what he wants to be is a girl. Hi, Lori. Thanks so much for joining me on this podcast today.
Hi, Gully. Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with the traditional New Books question. How did you come to write this lovely novel?
Yeah, that's such a good traditional question and also kind of a tough one. Some of the short answer is, it's my third novel. So I always try to start the next one as I'm finishing the previous one, because otherwise it's very difficult to get started again, I think. And this particular one, I was really drawn to the idea, lots of the ideas, I guess, surrounding it. But in particular, I was interested in the idea that two parents facing the situation that the parents in this book are facing could show up and both want to be really supportive and on board, but come at it from two really opposite points of view. And that I thought would make a really interesting novel. It is a novel about a transgender kid, and I have a transgender kid, but neither one of those things were clear to me at the beginning of the process. I wasn't sure the book was going in that direction. I wasn't sure the kid was going in that direction. And that is true frequently of both novel writing and child raising, as it turns out.
Right. So you started with that idea of a transgender child.
I did. I was really interested. I had no interest at all, actually, in telling a story about one parent is really supportive and ready to get on board, and one parent is of the no, I hate it, I hate you, get out of my house. If you don't change this behavior, you cannot live under my roof. I know that happens, but I did not want to talk about it and want to put it out there. I don't think, frankly, it's a very interesting story. It's a much more interesting story, it seems to me, to have both parents say, yes, heck yes, we want to support you. Of course, we're going to love you no matter what. Of course, we're going to do everything we can for you. But then the much more interesting question is, okay, great, how? Whether seems like a pretty boring question. How is an enormous question, and it's the kind of question it takes 350 pages to answer, and it's what makes a good book.
Mm-hmm. So This Is How It Always Is opens with the mother and her husband trying to conceive a daughter. So even though the mother, Rosie, is a doctor, she finds herself following all kinds of superstitious ideas, stories, in hopes of having a girl after having four boys. So let's talk about the use of mythology and superstition in this novel.
Yeah. It's funny for her because she is a doctor. One of the things that I knew going into this book is that I was going to need her to be a doctor for for a couple of reasons. One is I tried to switch the gender roles as much as possible. So she's the scientist and she's the doctor and she's the breadwinner. And he is an artist and he is a writer and he is a stay-at-home parent. And I wanted to flip them. I also knew I was going to need a doctor because there are lots of medical stuff that happens in this book that was going to need, that the reader was going to need an explanation on. And she provides that, is able to provide that. And so I knew I was going to need those things, but she's a fully developed character. And one of the things that is true about humans and fully developed characters is that they don't always make sense. They aren't always consistent. They aren't always logical. And so while on the one hand, she is a scientist and she knows that all of the things that she tries to conceive a girl, like putting a spoon under the bed, aren't going to work and don't have anything to do with, you know, what the sex of a baby. She does it anyway because she is human. And these are the sorts of things that we tell ourselves. Okay, I'm sure this isn't going to work, but yet it might. And so it doesn't cost me much to try and I'll try it anyway. And so it was a nice way to open the book because it introduces us to all of the inconsistencies of that character. And really of all characters.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about so she's the emergency room doctor and he, Penn, is struggling to finish his DN.
Right. Yeah. The DN is damn novel and a term I use myself sometimes, although sometimes I substitute a less nice word even than the D. Writing novels is hard. and they go where they will. They go in all sorts of directions. So yeah, he is a struggling writer. And that seemed really important to me too, that to think about the creative process and the way it lasts over the course of a whole thing, that the struggles with the creative process are not something that is resolved usually in a moment of revelation or, you know, a week of creative output. It's something that he struggles with over the course of really like the 10 years over which this novel takes place. And gosh, 10 years seems awfully realistic to me as far as how long it might take to figure out, you know, how to write a book.
Yeah. And this is your third. So they meet and fall in love and get married and start a family. And I particularly enjoyed how your writing is in the style of an old-fashioned love story. If I hadn't known it was about a transgender child, I would have thought for the first 50 or so pages that it was a love story.
It is a love story. And I think that all stories are love stories, really. And I also, as I say, I wasn't really interested in writing a book where the parents are in real battle with one another. I was much more interested in the parents being towards one another and towards their children, loving and supportive, and that still being fraught and difficult, because of course it is. That is much more interesting to me. I get very frustrated when I read books or watch TV or movies where people are just screaming at each other all the time. I don't find it enjoyable. I don't find it relatable, but mostly I don't find it interesting. So I was much more wanting a relationship where these two people really love and support each other and yet disagree about important and fundamental things and therefore have to find a way to proceed that is both honoring themselves whilst also honoring one another.
You know what? You're right. That is different, that they have this they clearly love each other. They have a wonderful relationship. And then they have this thing that they disagree with, but always respectfully, mostly. I want to say mostly respectfully. So the brothers, Rue, Ben, Rigel, and Orion, are these rambunctious little boys. And then Claude is born. What makes him so different from the very outset?
Well, you know, I think everything and nothing makes him very different from the outset, in that all kids are unique. All kids, I think, though, also look the same from the outside, and particularly in large families where, you know, you just think of that big pack of kids, and then they slowly differentiate themselves from one another. Claude is different in all sorts of ways. Immediately, what they notice is that he's really precocious. He walks early and talks early and reads early. They chalk that up to being the youngest of five. And, you know, and that he's just emulating his siblings. And that makes perfect sense to me, that you would think nothing more of his being precocious other than his being the youngest of five. But also, it's a wonderful thing. He's bright and smart and interested and engaged and enthusiastic. He's not getting lost in the fray of this household. And all of that is really wonderful and something to be grateful for. But it means that when he starts to get sad and he starts to get quiet and he starts to get lost, their warning bells go off right away.
Mm-hmm. You use an interesting device of suddenly another chapter going back in history. And one of the times you start telling the story about Rosie's sister. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Rosie loses her sister when she's very young to cancer. It is one of the things that makes her want to be a doctor. And it is also something that we see shape her and her children, who of course never have the opportunity to meet their aunt, you know, throughout all of their lives. And that too strikes me as the kind of thing that is sometimes used as a device and then dropped. And what I found that it kept coming back, as I think it would, because it is so formative and so important and really such a hole in her life and in her mother's life, but also in her kids' lives, even though they never had an opportunity to meet her. The fact that they didn't have this opportunity to meet her is itself an enormous loss that they're all keenly aware of.
Mm-hmm. So then at age three, Claude announces that he wants to be a girl. What's the standard approach right now? Because of course, the old standard approach in my generation was to completely pay no attention to what the child wanted.
Right.
Wants. What's the standard approach now? And do Rosie and Penn follow it?
I think, well, so... That's such a huge question. It's such a good and huge question. The short answer, I suppose, is that there is no standard approach. And that seems to me to be true of parenting in general, that these things present themselves and at first you don't quite know what you're dealing with. And so you proceed, do with the best guess you have, with the most information you can get at the time that it presents itself. When Claude first says at age three that he wants to be a girl and that he wants to wear dresses, and that it doesn't strike his parents as something that they should be alarmed about. And indeed, I think that it is not. It certainly is not anyone's best practice to at that point say, oh my gosh, you must be transgender. Let's, you know, go down to the courthouse and get you a new birth certificate and all of that. That isn't what anyone is suggesting. And it is absolutely true that lots and lots of little boys will want to wear dresses. And that's the wonderful thing. Not all of those little boys are going to become little girls. Not all of those little boys are going to be transgender, not even most of them. And the suggestion that they are would itself be extraordinarily alarming. And so it's a really very slow process of growing up, as growing up always is, and Rosie and Penn take it as it comes. And at the beginning, it not only isn't alarming to them, it isn't anything that requires anything at all on their part, you know, other than to say, sure, yeah, let's play dress up. That sounds fun. And so it's a really long time for them before it crosses into something that does cause them pause. And that evolution itself is and must be and ought to be very slow and in development, you know, as children are.
Right. I should have asked what is the healthy approach rather than the standard.
What's
the most healthful approach? That's what I meant.
Yeah. And so I think that's the same answer probably.
Okay. Yeah. So then there's this wonderful psychologist whose phone number I'd like.
Right, yeah.
He's the voice of calm and assurance, but he's also the dispenser of wise advice. And he's this brilliant voice in their ears. Is he based on someone in your life or someone we all want in our lives?
Yeah, alas, the latter. He is based on someone we all want in our lives. In early drafts, he was 7 or 8 different characters, all of whom showed up to do one scene of, you know, a pediatrician and an endocrinologist and a therapist and a psychologist. And they would show up and do their one scene and then go away again. And that doesn't work in a novel. Frankly, it doesn't work that great in real life either, but it definitely doesn't work in a book. So then in later drafts, he had to become one person. And then he was kind of a weird person because he used to be all of these different people. And then the choice was to kind of unweird him or to weird him up, to make him make more sense or less. And I, as you see, I sort of doubled down on that decision. And he becomes a very quirky guy who goes in lots and lots of directions. And as with having a doctor main character, tells the reader a lot of things that we probably don't know and need to, but also is as you say, the dispenser of advice and wisdom that Rosie and Penn need as parents.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about how the issue about where Poppy should go to the bathroom at school and how the issue is handled, how it's being handled in our society today.
Yes. It's a big question because it varies so enormously from state to state and district to district and school to school. Truthfully, I think it is much ado about nothing. I don't actually think that the bathroom issue is a real issue. I think it is a made up issue, mostly to, I think, incite fear and anger and drive people to the polls. I just don't think it is real. In Washington State, where I live, the protections have been on the books for a dozen years that entitle students to use the bathroom that aligns with their gender identity. And that has been incident free, 100% without incident for 12 years. So this suggestion that we see sometimes, and indeed that makes it to the ballot sometimes, that if that is what happens, that if kids and adults are allowed to use the bathroom that matches their gender identity, that this will be unsafe or that this will result in violence is simply untrue. It is also, of course, completely unenforceable. The notion that an elementary school is going to station someone outside of bathrooms and like ask kids to pull down their pants and prove which restroom they should be using, that's what would be absurd. That's what would be upsetting to us. So in fact, this is just a situation that many schools have solved in the way that is solved in the book. That is, I did not make that up. That solution where it's like, okay, well, you child cannot be made to use this bathroom, cannot be allowed to use this bathroom, so you have to go use the nurse's bathroom, is in fact the solution that lots and lots of schools have settled on. But it is one that is unnecessary because in fact, it's saying to children, you identify as a gender, go and use that bathroom, is a thing that not only is safe and without incident, it is something that kids completely understand.
So you agree we'd be better off with a sign that says, we don't care what you are, just please wash your hands?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Okay. Hand washing. I'm very pro hand washing. That is, yes, for sure.
Me too. All right. Until Poppy experiences homophobia, the Walsh Adams family lives in this big old farmhouse in Madison, Wisconsin, and they pick up and move to Seattle. But Madison, home of a Big Ten school and to two of my children, yeah, is known as a tolerant, open community.
Absolutely.
So
it is, absolutely. And I love Madison. And I am at pains to say this. The family's decision to move from Madison to Seattle is driven really entirely by Rosie, the mother. And it is meant to suggest that she's gone a little bit crazy, maybe even a lot crazy. She is driven around the bend. She witnesses this incident of terrible violence and reacts to it, as we so often do, by thinking, I am not safe and my children are not safe. I am their mom and I have to protect them at all costs. To me, it's actually a very similar idea to the one that you were asking about before that opens the book, where she's a doctor, but this little part of her brain thinks, if I put a spoon under the bed, I will conceive a girl. And right. And similarly, the logical part of her is thinking one thing, but the mom part of her is all mama bear, is all thinking like, I must protect my child at all costs. This terrible thing has happened. What we have to do is flee. One of the things that she has to learn over the course of the book is that packing up and moving is not always the answer and isn't even possible. And that sometimes what she has to do is stay and fight. So that is, you know, her journey over the course of the thing. For my part, I, as the author of this, I just needed, the book takes place in four parts, but really in three acts. And I wanted a physical movement in between each of them to indicate it. So it's not just that they leave Madison for Seattle, but they leave the Midwest for the coast, and that they leave what is sprawling and wide and flat for something that is very green and hilly and a city. It's all of these changes in their lives that I wanted to be able to show in lots of ways rather than just the one way. It also, you know, of course, drives the plot. They're suddenly faced with this question that they have not had to face yet, which is, who do you tell and how? And it drives much of the second half of the novel, and I wouldn't have been able to do it if I hadn't moved them. So in some ways, it's just a plot consideration.
Is Poppy affected the same way many children who discover that they're transgender, that they want to be the opposite gender? It seemed to me that she wasn't as affected, that she just goes happily on her way, delighted with everything, happy to wear a ponytail, just enjoying life like a regular child. And it's everybody around her who seem nervous and upset.
Indeed. I mean, of course, she is a regular child, and so are all children, really. It is, for me, where the title comes from. This is how it always is. I think that most parents will not have a transgender child, but most parents will have a child who is sometimes gender nonconforming, and all parents will have children who are sometimes nonconforming, period. Sometimes kids fit in, and sometimes kids are weird. I mean, you know, kids are weird. And so there are many ways in which she is very middle of the pack, and some ways in which she falls on an end of the spectrum. And I think that is true of all children. It was why I was so insistent on doing five siblings, is because it seemed to me to be the best way to look at the ways in which none of these kids fits in all of the time. All of those kids have problems sometimes. And sometimes the ways in which they fail to fit in are great. We think, oh, this child is so creative and so unusual, and this is really wonderful. And sometimes we think, oh, no, that's not okay. That kind of weird doesn't work for us. And intervention is required. And it's interesting to me which things fall into which category on those fronts. Poppy really is a very normal, healthy child because she is supported at home. Kids who experience problems when they are gender nonconforming, it is because they are not welcomed by other parts of their life. So if they are not being supported at home, or they're not being supported in their community, or they're not being supported at school, that's where those problems come from. Poppy is really lucky in that her parents say, okay, let's do this thing. Let's figure out how to make the logistics work to support you. And that, I think, is what elementary schools and parents are doing all the time in so many different ways for so many different cases, and ought to be. And those kids thrive in direct proportion to how loved and supported they are, as do we all.
Mm-hmm. And so in addition to that wonderful therapist, the other wise, loving presence for the family, and especially for Poppy, is Rosie's mother.
Right, yes. Yeah, my books always have grandmothers in them. The new one that I'm working on wasn't going to, and then she appeared. it's not something that I usually decide to do going in, but she always shows up. I was very close with both of my grandmothers. My kid is very close with my mother. I'm a big believer in grandmothers. The other thing, though, that was interesting to me and seemed important to talk about in this case is that so frequently parents of transgender kids get right on board, but they're very nervous about telling their parents. There's all of this trauma around telling the grandparents because they think the grandparents are not going to understand. And much more often than not, the grandparents surprise you. The grandparents also get right on board. Grandparents, first of all, have seen a lot because they are not yet spring chickens. They're not young. And they've been around some time. And also, this, I think, is what grandparents suit up for, this unconditional love. I don't care about the details. I don't need to worry about the day-to-day. I just am going to love you because you are my grandkid. That seems to me to be what grandparents suit up for. So in this case, it seemed really important to be able to stand up for those grandparents who are ready to stand up for their grandkids.
Mm-hmm. Love the grand Carmelo.
Yeah.
So there's tension, obviously, for many reasons, just families and raising five children and Penn not finishing his book, all kinds of things. But the real tension that they need to overcome as a family is when they decide to keep Poppy's background a secret.
Right. Yes. And this is something that was just really important to honor and acknowledge in addition to it drives the novel. So the kind of novelist answer that I want to give is that while you want your life to be free of plot and drama, you want your novel to be full of plot and drama. Secrets are a really wonderful thing to put in a novel because they have to come out eventually. So you keep reading to find out when they will and how and what will happen next. So there's that, you know, kind of very, very simple answer. That said, I know a lot of transgender people. I know a lot of transgender children and their parents at this point, and more of them than not, especially the kids, are in fact living what is called stealth. They aren't out. People don't know. And there are lots of really wonderful arguments on both sides of that debate. And they are entirely individual. It depends on the kid. It depends on the family. It depends on the community. It depends on the circumstances and the situations. They are very, very complicated questions. But I know an awful lot of people who have made this decision. And then the question becomes, okay, if you're not telling everybody right away, then who and when and how? And that becomes a really difficult question. I have probably thought about this question more than any single human being on earth between, you know, raising a child myself and writing this book. And it wasn't a question that was ever on the table for us because we didn't move. We've been here the whole time. Everyone we know knows. They watched it happen. It is not a fast process. And it is not one that can be done in secret for the most part. So it wasn't a question for us. But if we moved, I still don't know what we would do because it is for exactly the reasons that they face in the book. It's a very difficult thing to lead off with. It's not something you say after, hi, my name is, but it is also a really difficult time to find, difficult challenge to find the right moment anytime thereafter. And that's how secrets start getting kept. And it is a difficult, nuanced, fraught thing, which makes it a great thing to put in a book, but a difficult thing to live with.
There's so much going on in this novel in addition to these issues we've discussed. And I absolutely loved Penn's long-running fairy tale, right, the story that he tells the boys every night. It's just an amazing, consistent lessons about tolerance and differences, and he makes it into an amazing story. Can you address that?
Yes, thank you. I'm so glad you liked it. It was one of those things that I thought of in the very seat of the book. And I thought, oh, this is going to be a nice device to help you keep track of, you know, where you are in the book. And it's going to be really easy to write. And it's going to help me, you know, write the book. It's going to help you read the book. It's going to be great. And then it was the hardest thing. And I revised and revised and revised and revised it, which is another thing that happens frequently between the planning stages and the actual execution of the book. In this case, it seemed like the perfect device because fairy tales are foundational. They are the building blocks of the rest of the stories we tell. They are often the first stories we tell our kids. They're often the first movies that our children see. They cross time and cultures and nations. All of these, you know, these wonderful things, and they're great stories. But they're really problematic for children in general, and I think transgender children in particular, because fairy tales are all about transformation, but that transformation is instantaneous, it is painless, it is total. You know, once Cinderella becomes a princess, nobody is saying to her, like, hey, remember last week when you were on your knees cleaning the kitchen? And certainly no one is saying to her, you are really a kitchen maid at heart. You aren't a princess. That's pretend. And that is, and so therefore they become difficult stories for kids. It is also true that in fairy tales, the transformation is itself a reward for being good. So if you fail to transform or fail to transform entirely, it is because you have been bad. And that is also a really problematic message for these kids. So I was very interested in what we could keep about these stories about transformation and that would be useful and meaningful and what about them could be adjusted and changed to keep the idea of a fairy tale, but make them work better for children who are undergoing actual change, which is very rarely painless and very rarely total and very, very rarely instantaneous.
I thought more about The Ugly Duckling than Cinderella in terms of transformation when I was reading the story. But okay, but Cinderella works too.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, that's what all of these stories are. It's very interesting if you take them down to the building blocks and you look at their manifestations in other cultures. What you find is that that is what they're about. They're about change, and how exactly that happens and what exactly it looks like varies widely. But in fact, the stories are mostly about the lead up to the change. The change itself is offered as climax and denouement, and that's lovely. It's just it speaks to one part of being a kid, and then there are all of these other parts too.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to quote something Rosie says and hope you will address it. Rosie says, this is a medical issue, but mostly it's a cultural issue. It's a social issue and an emotional issue and a family dynamic issue and a community issue.
Yes. So how do I want to say this? All of those things are true, but this is also a part in the novel where she is speaking to Penn's desire to treat it just as a medical issue or to treat it from a medical angle, to medicate and then move on. And her argument is that isn't a decision that medication issue is not a decision she feels comfortable making for her minor child, and also is only part of the issue at hand. When adult transgender people make decisions as to treatment, they're able to take into account all sorts of things that kids just are not. And so there are many ways in which this is medical. There are many ways in which it is physical. There are many ways in which it is emotional. And there are all of these ways in which it is outside of the self and the person in particular. And so all of those things are part of it. It's big. And of course it is, because issues of identity are enormous. We wouldn't think otherwise. So this is just, this part of the book is her parents getting their heads around what it means. It is difficult to think about identity issues for a child because children change every day. And so part of Rosie's concern is making decisions for a kid who's going to be a new person next week, next month, next year, because that is the state of childhood.
Yeah. So, Lori, I've taken up so much of your time, and I know it's almost time for school pickup. So we're going to end with
a lovely though. You're grand.
Traditional new books question. What are you working on? Yeah. What are you working on now? What's next?
So I am in the, I want to say final revision throws, though final might be optimistic. I'm in revision throws, let's say late revision throws on the next novel, which is called 1, 2, 3, and which will be out probably not this winter, but next, we hope. And you know, and that is, as I said at the beginning, that is how I stay sane, is by always starting, making sure that the next book is underway, because writing novels is daunting. They're very long, and if you don't start the next one, I at least get sort of mired in the possibilities. So that is, it is drafted, it is solved, and I'm hopeful that the revision process isn't going to be too terrible, though. Gosh, you just never know.
Right. Good luck with everything. Thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you, Gali. Thank you so much. It's really lovely to do this and to chit chat with you.
And thank you for listening to this podcast from the New Books Network. Once again, I'm GP Gottlieb, host of New Books in Literature. And today I've been talking with Lori Frankel about her novel, This Is How It Always Is. If you're looking for something to read, join the New Books Network for podcast interviews about wonderful books in a variety of subjects. Goodbye and happy reading.